Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening and welcome to Gather Round. I'm Ra with Anna Marcy Theo, and tonight in just a bit we're going to have Janet Schmidt, a fellow lifestylist. We're going to talk about summertime. And at the half hour mark we've got Sarit Jacobson coming in with her views of the world, which always will include Palestine and Israel, and possibly some other countries also. So here we go. Today's flash update was something good, and you know, this should have been settled years and years ago. However, in the U.S. Appellate Court, Appeals Court today in the state of Utah, the state was told that it may not ban gay couples from marrying. The decision is going to be taken up to the Supreme Court, evidently, so things are on hold. But around the same time, a federal district judge in Indiana said that the state's ban on gay marriages was unconstitutional. And so within moments of this decision, the first couple arrived for their marriage license. And they said by mid-afternoon, there were 50 couples with licenses and more people waiting. So, you know, sooner or later it's going to happen, and people who are against it may as well get used to it. You know, really, who someone is sleeping with, having sex with, living with, marrying is nobody's business. It shouldn't be the business of the state. If people want to cohabit, like, go for it. And if people, for religious, spiritual reasons, want to have their union blessed in a church, a mosque, a synagogue, the open air for us pagans, wherever, you know, that's their right. The state really should stay out of this. And more good news. I'm full of good news tonight. In Nigeria, four teenage girls have created a generator. It will produce electricity for 6 hours, and the fuel is a single liter of urine. Now, I don't know, I mean, you know, that sounds so strange and all, but I'm so excited because even though so many towns and states in the U.S. are trying to do away with science or whatever, you know, they're making it like a back burner issue, other countries actually are educating their children. And they're coming up with these wonderful ideas. And, you know, we know that fossil fuel energy is really hard on all of us, hard on the planet. We've got to go to other forms. And there's so many forms that are going to be fairly free, if not totally free, the solar power, wind power. And something like this, let's face it, there's plenty of pee around. So, you know, this just made me really smile. I thought, this is excellent. And back to simplicity. Now, that's pretty simple. I mean, when it gets down to it, this is, you know, this is totally renewable. And something else is simple. In just a few minutes, Janet Schmidt and I will be talking about summertime and, you know, living it to the max. But one thing that I found that is simple, oh my goodness, is simple and good, and it works for me, is something that's called monomeals. And this is, you know, not something maybe that you want to do for each meal. I'm not even suggesting that. But a meal a day or an occasional meal, particularly in summer, is so good. Just grab those mangoes and eat as many as you want, or grab the bananas, eat as many. You know, it's just very simple. And I also was reminded the other day that all of these kinds of fruits that we cut, whether it's melon, whether it's cantaloupe, the aforementioned mangoes, anything like this, when you get it home, you don't need to like clean it right then, but before you're going to cut into it and eat, please scrub it down. You can just use water. You don't have to get some kind of a fancy type of soap, but it needs to be scrubbed, because if you've ever looked under a microscope at these, just like a cantaloupe, the lines just go on, and all kinds of little germs can hide in there. So just scrub it down, cut it up, and you can have a complete mono meal. And actually, your body will thank you, because it's so much easier to digest. And in this kind of weather that we're having, at least in the NoHem up here, I know under the equator it's wintertime, but I'm above and I'm in heat. I think that we're actually going to talk about that shortly. So to get you in the mood, let's just play a little bit of this song. I heard that song, and that it was just by a friend of a friend just burst out singing it. We were on Belle Island in Michigan, right across from Detroit, and it was amazing. I had never heard it. It just blew me away how she sang, and then I found that this was one of Billie Holiday's biggies. So. Yeah. Welcome, Janet Schmidt, my fellow lifestylist. How are you this humid day?
Oh, God. Today the humidity just seems so bad. I mean, Saturday I was out in it all day.
Right.
And it was hot. But I thought there was less humidity. The humidity today is just astounding, even inside.
Well, yeah, I don't have air conditioner or anything. So I mean, I do want to like feel the change in the seasons, and I definitely do. But getting on to summertime and the living being easy, you know what? I always think, and like in the middle of the wintertime, I start thinking about sarongs. And, you know, so that by the time spring gets here, I'm for sure I've got them all lined up. So,
yeah.
What do you notice clothes-wise, the changes?
Well, less is better when it's hot, you know.
Yeah. And don't
not,
you lighter fabrics and things?
Well, lighter fabric. Now, I just had an argument with somebody over whether, you know, you really need to be in light colors to stay cool. And I don't know if it's because over a number of years I've acclimated myself to wearing darker colors year-round. It doesn't necessarily, the color doesn't bother me. But, yeah, of course, you need to go with lighter fabrics.
Yeah.
And I think looser, too. You know, I was, like I said, Saturday I spent all day outside at a Pride event, which was lovely. And I noticed a lot of people wearing very tight clothes. And they just looked hotter than people that just a little bit looser. Now, I don't think you look smaller when you wear clothes that are too small for you. You look fatter.
Well, if they're too small for you, you don't look good in them anyway. But what you're saying is really
right.
true, I think. Because I like long dresses and long skirts and sarongs and things that flow, though. And, you know, I love wearing jeans, but make mine early in the morning or late at night if it's summertime. I really don't want to wear jeans during the day.
Yeah, you're right. See, I'm really big on leggings. I'm not as fond of jeans as I used to be when I was younger. I like leggings or knit pants, cotton knit pants like yoga pants. But I recently bought this beautiful maxi skirt, cause, and then I found out they're in. That's why they're, I guess, why they're in all the stores, duh. And they are great. I mean, I want to get more because they are comfortable, and I think people look nice in them. I noticed, you know, being at an event, there were a lot of people wearing maxis, a lot of women wearing the maxi skirts, and they're very comfortable. Even though it was longer, they were loose, and, you know, the excess fabric in the length, I was still cool.
Well, I've done that for years because I really don't give a flying fuck about fashion, but I just like white to comfortable. And because they do flow, you can get more air going somehow. Because, I mean, I wear something short, and I'm sure not any cooler than I am if I have a long, lightweight dress or skirt on. And so I think it's definitely something to remember. And the colors, I'm like you, I wear dark colors, but more in the cold weather just because. But I have some beautiful summer dresses that are black with other colors on them.
Well, I know you have a really pretty one. I remember seeing you in it. Just stuck with me, which with this beautiful floral print. And
I know the one. Yeah, it had some pink on it.
Floral prints seem to me to be a summer thing, don't you think? That I mean, I don't normally wear them year-round.
Right. Well, now some, if they're big print, big flowers, big bold Georgia O'Keeffe flowers, can be winter. And there again, it's going to depend on your fabric.
Right.
But I agree, like the smaller flowery prints, very much a summer thing, at least for me. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, because it just...
One thing I wanted to mention, because I'm one of the fortunate ones who has a porch I can actually use. And
I know.
I
covet your porch, and you know it.
I know.
She's got the greatest porch. It's just perfect, and you can sit there and eat and just live on her porch.
Yeah, because it's big enough. And some of our listeners know I have the top of a two flat, and so the front porch is actually shared. You know, I mean, I just take like half, my half. My neighbor
but
really does.
You got the best half.
But I've got the best half, yeah.
And I think so, for sitting there and looking out at what's coming down the street, and it's just perfect.
It is. And in early morning, I can go out and have water, tea, my lemon water. I've got to get to market tomorrow because I'm out of almost every kind of fruit, and that includes lemons. But just writing, reading, eating. I mean, my porch is great. So I would suggest that if people have a porch, a balcony or something, they make use of it. Now, Janet and I have a friend, or friends actually, who have a balcony with a wonderful view of the city. I mean, this is an excellent view. And you know what? Surprised me because they're very good about decorating the homes they've lived in. They've done nothing with that balcony. And
really?
That hurts my heart because it's so perfect. I mean, it's one of the bigger balconies.
And now they're moving, so they never will do that balcony.
Right. So now I don't know, a lot of the people who live in their the complex, they're are students, and sometimes students' apartments definitely look like dorms. And, you know, so maybe students aren't going to buy anything or do much work on theirs. But these aren't, this isn't the case with these people, but they just have done nothing with that beautiful balcony. And, you know, like the minimum is get a couple nice chairs. And you know, I think you like those little cafe tables like I do.
I do. But the I like wicker furniture, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I got some wicker furniture this year given to me. A really nice chair and love seat, and I want to get a table.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about Ruth Ann's porch, which I covet because I don't have one. We have our house sits right on the front, and there's really no place for a porch. I mean, what we call a little front porch, it's not big enough to put tables on and be safe.
Yeah.
And so this really bums me out because obviously I'd like to sit in the front, and it also, you know, it would to fix that would be an amazing amount of money. But what we're doing, and we haven't got this done yet because May and June have been horrendously busy. July looks to be a little bit more home time. I saw this on the internet somewhere where people, you know, to make things, because I like Ruth Ann, I like to reuse, reduce, and recycle and all that. And we're making a back deck out of pallets.
Mm-hmm.
It's ground level. And it's really cool. I saw it. When I do get this, I'm going to have before and after pictures because it's cool. It's just pallets. And instead of buying a bunch of wood that you have to nail on it, you'll see it's going to be really cute. You can use the pallets. And we're going to paint it, unify them with paint. And so we're going to approximate a back deck / porch.
Right.
Where I can sit and hopefully not get ate alive by mosquitoes, which is another problem with this humidity. They're horrible here.
Right, right.
You know, the state bird of Illinois is just the bane of my summer.
Well, you know what you're doing with the pallets or skids? Even as a child, I played with those because my parents would get them from the store and for their store, and I've always played with them. I love them. But, you know, you can also, with those, just do you know how you make a floor covering out of canvas or some kind of fabric, and, you know, any size of rug and things, you can make something like that and put it down if there's a certain place you want. And
well, that's what I intend to do. I mean, we're going to put the pallets down, and, like, I want to paint them, I think, barn red. We've kind of decided on that.
Ah.
That it'll look funky because we have so much greenery. You know, I thought about going green, but then it would blend in. We thought the red would kind of be cool. And then other things will be colorful on it. And then I thought of that where we have a sitting area, put it, and they have, you can get really nice outdoor rugs now that can be rained on and not ruined. And
you can also make your own. That was my point. If, you know, because,
well, how could you make, what would you make your own out of?
You just look up floor covering. Oh, one thing that people have been using is old linoleum. You know, like somebody takes linoleum, which is, fun, you know, old, and you can just use that. But canvas.
I don't have any of them.
The canvas, bits and pieces.
And then you could probably waterproof it.
Yeah. Just put poly over it after you get it done. But something I was thinking about using for small rugs. Now, I don't know, you have cats and dogs, and I get big bags of cat food, and on the inside of them, it's white already, and I've thought about using that because it's made out of some recyclable stuff. It is waterproof to start with, and I thought about using those for small rugs.
You just gave me a great idea, though, with canvas, because you can buy painter's cloths really cheap. Mm-hmm. They're relatively inexpensive. To maybe paint a design, that would be really cool.
Well, you were talking about design, yeah. I mean, so that's what you get something in, and you paint it up with whatever, you know. With me, chances are it's going to be something celestial, but it doesn't always have to be.
Well, I was thinking of I have an idea in my head of like a green man type thing. It might work. But I was going to say, I mentioned mosquitoes. I found a natural insect repellent recipe online because we were out of it the other day, and some, you know, like I said, we live in a very old house. I've talked to other people about this. And occasionally the little critters get inside the house, which
yeah.
is, you know, not good. And I realized we were out of bug spray. And this is early in the morning. I decided to make some. And this was so easy, and it really works. It works as well as anything I've ever bought. The Center for Disease Control has said that lemon eucalyptus essential oil is as effective as DEET against mosquitoes. And it's much better for you because DEET is really bad.
DEET's a killer.
And it was the recipe I had, it couldn't be simpler. Now, I made this just this amount. I'm going to make a bigger batch tomorrow. You need about 2 tablespoons of a carrier oil, and it's, you can use pretty much any oil. And when I did it the other day, I used a little olive oil. Tomorrow I'm going to use coconut oil because I have a lot of it. And
yeah.
you need, it said 2 tablespoons of rubbing alcohol or vodka. Well, of course, I couldn't find a rubbing alcohol, so I used a little Grey Goose, which I will not use again. I'd rather drink it. And then 55 drops of lemon eucalyptus oil. And then 15 drops of cedarwood, 15 drops of rosemary, and 15 drops of lavender. Now, I think I'm going to mess with that a little bit and put more peppermint in it. I might go with the cedarwood and lavender and add peppermint because that's also effective against mosquitoes, and I think it'll smell mintier. But it smelled really good, and you shake this up, and I put it in a spray bottle so you can be mixing it in that, and it's just awesome. And I sprayed a little bit into just a little bit of some unscented hand cream that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, probably enough to do your arms 2 or 3 times. And I sprayed it about 8 times. So it was, there was quite a bit of the mixture, and then blended it, and that way it could be a easier on your skin, you know, and easier to spread. Because, like I said, living in an old house, we occasionally get them in the house. So I wanted something I could wear a lot. It's going to be economical.
Right.
It's going to be healthier for me. So I think when I make it tomorrow, I might actually text some. I have some shea butter, and I might melt. I might soften up the shea butter and whip in some of the stuff with it and see how that goes. But that's great. And, I mean, you can use candles outside and various things. I mean, tiki torch oil has a lot of it comes with citronella, but now with what I've read, I think I will put lemon eucalyptus in it.
Yeah, no, that, and that sounds like it smells just great.
It smells lovely.
Mention to people about mosquitoes, you know, something people just don't seem to realize sometimes that, you know, we're not saying don't have bird baths. Go ahead, have the bird bath. Have your water bowls outside for neighboring animals, but change it every day. Don't let it set. And
check other things because you have, you know, water. We had a big water leak this year. Which I'm going to say, thankfully, was between our house and the outdoor pipe, which is halfway down our long black backyard. And I've often wondered why the hell somebody put it there anyway, why they didn't have the outdoor spigot right on the back of the house like so many do. Well, I get a water bill that's like $500. And I had a fucking heart attack. Pardon me for dropping the F-bomb. And I'm like, oh, my God. And so at the same time, I have another letter from the water company saying, we noticed you had high water usage. There could be a leak. And I'm thinking, yeah, it's not my teenager taking long showers. It's a leak. And so it took us a long time to track it down because of the way the outdoor water pipe is. We have an old house again. And it was run off from the front of the house, and it's a tiny little pipe that snaked around the ceiling of our cellar. And we finally found it, and it's like, oh my God, if this is a leak between, and we had a very cold winter, so it's probably what happened, that we cannot dig our yard up. I cannot afford $10,000 to have someone like dig it up, replace the pipe, and it would ruin a bunch of stuff in our yard. And I'm not kidding, it could cost anywhere from $6,000 to $10,000 to do this.
Oh God.
So I said, let's just cut the friggin' water off to that pipe, and then we could redo one from the laundry room right to the outside wall because it has an outside wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a lot cheaper to do that, to run a new pipe off the laundry room. And so we have not done that yet because we just finally got the leak fixed a month ago.
Well,
and it's just like I said, June's been hectic. So we have to carry water out to water the garden unless it rains. And we've got things to collect water in, which is great to have, you know, if it rains and we've had a lot of rain to collect it, but you got to watch this with the mosquitoes, you know, to get it dumped.
You've got to use it then. You collect it, use it.
I'm going to explore this. There is some kind of little tablets you can get to throw in water, which will kill the mosquitoes and are supposed to be safe for, you know, watering your plants. I'm going to double check that.
Well, you know, you've got,
I use it.
That's a different problem than mine, but I don't have, because I'm on the second floor of a two flat, I don't have an outside faucet either.
Good.
So I have to take water. And, you know, this is, I swear by next year, if I'm still living in the same place, I'm going to have figured out how to put up a solar shower, not necessarily solar, an outdoor shower.
I've been wanting one.
Well, but you, and it's not hard for you because you're on the ground level. But
mm-hmm.
I'm not, and I don't have an outside, like I said, faucet.
Well, where would you want to have the shower at then?
In the back. Just back. I don't know if you've been here since the ex-neighbor built a piece of something out there. Anyway, I mean, it wouldn't be that far from the house. So I could conceivably get a hose long enough to hook to my kitchen sink faucet and spread it out a window. So I'm going to think about that.
Yeah, because you wouldn't have to, you'd have to fill it. It depends on how often you used it. I've seen these at Bass Pro at camping supply stores, and they're not that expensive. The shower bag or whatever you call it.
Right. One time when we were camping, one of our friends brought one of those. And, that would be, you know.
They work well.
The bag was one of those, like, I don't know what it's made out of, but it was something that if you had it out in the sun, it would heat up faster than
It's like heavy mylar.
It was.
That helps.
It is a possibility. I just actually wanted to have more water.
I don't know, 5 gallons, does that sound like very much for a shower? I don't think so.
No, I wouldn't be necessarily, I mean, if I had a lot of water, I would be doing the shower to clean also. If I didn't have that much water, it would be more of a cool down kind of, because I love when we go places where the showers are outside for festivals and things. I mean, I'm just, I love, love, love. And the best I've been in, have been in Indiana. There's a couple that were just excellent. At La Florian is one, and another is at R Haven. R Haven has the best festival showers in the world. And, the outside thing. So I thought, well, if I don't have heat, if I just did the cold water, that's fine. That would, you know, cool you off in the summer. But also, if people are able to fix a solar heater outside, that would work for them better, because that way they don't have to transport hot water. And so if they just have a solar heater. But if I do mine, if I hook it to the kitchen sink faucet, I can just put a little hot water in there too, you know, get a...
I'm just wondering, where would you actually, on the ground, put the shower? Because I just had an idea, and I know you can get 5-gallon buckets, and I know you can get 55-gallon drums, but I'm wondering if you couldn't get like a... You'd have to have somebody come over and help you do this. If you had a large container, I've seen directions to make an outdoor shower with a 55-gallon plastic drum.
Right.
Where they cut the hole and they put the pipe in and they have it running out to a shower head. And you can look on the internet, Google outdoor shower, and I mean, it seemed like it was pretty simple to do. You would have to support this on something.
Right.
And if it was on the side of the house where you could run the hose from the bathroom to it?
No, it would be from the kitchen. No.
Okay, from the kitchen.
Because, like I said, the ex-neighbor had built a, he told me he was going to build a treehouse, and I thought, well, that's interesting. For his kid, he would be, I thought he had talked to our neighbor on the west and was going to use his tree. That wasn't it.
Right.
He built this building thing up on stilts. And now the neighbor has said that maybe they will take it and be able to use the building thing. But it remains that there would still be like the stilt things and probably part of the floor. So there would be a beginning of a shelter.
Well, that would be awesome. You could put a, if you could get a 55-gallon plastic bucket. Now, I heard the metal ones, if you can buy a brand new metal one, you're going to have somebody that can weld with this, though, to put the hole in it and put the pipe in it and run the rod. You could put that on that platform, and the shower head can come out to the side and down.
Right.
And that could be underneath, it could be a shower.
Yeah. I'm just going to have to check and find somebody to be able to help with this, but I swear next year if I'm here, I'm going to have an outdoor shower. Janet, our time is up. And
oh, no. It seems so fast.
Talk. So thank you so much, and we will definitely do this again. How's
we will.
That?
Okay, thanks so much for having me, and I hope everybody has a great week.
Thank you so much, and I'll be talking with you tomorrow on Akasha Temple Live.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello, Miss Sarita Jacobson.
Hi.
Hi. And let's just get right into it because so much has been happening in Palestine and Israel. I mean, other places too, of course. But
collective punishment continues, and when the Zionists go mad, there's nothing that seems to stop them.
Well, they're still on this rant about three settlers being, wink, wink, kidnapped by Palestinians.
Yeah. When they don't know.
Well, even
the other settlers who did it.
Well, this is it. Even people who, a couple weeks ago when we said that in our opinion, it was something the Zionists were doing, another false flag. And people were going, oh, no, they wouldn't do such a thing. And now those very people are saying, well, you know what? You guys could be right. And, yeah, we know we could be right. I'd say there's probably a 90% chance that we are right. Because what's three people to them, really? I mean,
it wouldn't be the first time.
No. I mean, collateral is collateral, in their opinion.
I'm very sorry I can't keep up with the numbers of people that have been killed and kidnapped, but over 300 Palestinians have been kidnapped already, taken from their homes in the middle of their night by gunpoint, humiliated, tortured.
And you mean right now, since the settlers went missing. This is not an overall figure. This is in quote-unquote retaliation.
Yes, I'm getting horrific reports from the West Bank that every home is being broken into.
Can you imagine?
Everything. They break the washing machines, break people's TV, steal money if they can find it. They love finding porn so they can wave in front of the whole family to destroy the family. I read so many reports about Israeli soldiers breaking the silence, what house raids are like. From the Israeli soldiers' point of view, they also strip search the people in the house and check them. I hope women with women, but you never know.
Yeah. Because they're probably doing all people because it's a way to humiliate people.
Yeah.
And
undressing people. Definitely.
Because this is one of the last, you're supposed to be able to have control over your body, and what you wear or don't wear should be up to you kind of thing. And who you show your body to, this is a personal decision. But so they can use psychological warfare by just stripping people, strip searching, trying to demean and dehumanize them. And let's face it, the Zionists are really good at this. It's one of the
Nazis
things
did the same.
Yeah. Well, they learned in the Second World War. And the Zionists were part of what was going on there. Don't let anybody tell you differently. They many of them worked with the Nazis. They knew what was happening.
Yes, we have names in the book, Transfer Agreement, written by an Israeli guy who researched it. He paid a heavy price. His family will never talk to him again, even though they're Holocaust survivors.
Wow.
The book is by Nathan Black, called The Transfer Agreement.
Wait, the Transfer Agreement?
Yeah, his name is Black, I think, Nathan. I could look it up real fast. It's a wonderful book. Very, very, very good. So I hear a dog there.
Yes, you do. That's my neighbor's dog. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
Because like I was saying in my earlier, I don't have air conditioning or anything. I have open windows. And this is my neighbor's dog, you know, the house next to me. And there's a little bit of land between the two. And that dog is, I'm in that like the middle part of my house, and the dog is at the front of their house. And you can just hear it so quickly, right?
Yeah. The name of the author is Edwin Black. E-D-W-I-N Black.
Edwin. Okay.
There is a connection between the Zionists and the Nazis that Albert Einstein mentioned so in his letter where he warned the world about Zionism.
And people didn't want to listen because even then they were thinking, oh, they're being anti-Semitic. And I am so tired of that. I read something today, and I don't know if you've seen it yet. This was just before I came on the air, that somebody is using David Duke because David Duke supports the Palestinians, and he's anti-Zionist. And so they say, well, you know, because of his early history as a Ku Klux Klan leader and everything, he was anti-Semitic, which he says he isn't anymore. But they're trying to use him to say, well, if you don't support Israel and what they're doing to the Palestinians, then, you know, like the Presbyterians that voted to divest, he said, well, then you're anti-Semitic. So they're calling the Presbyterians anti-Semitic because David Duke had said that the Presbyterians did the right thing.
That will only stop when people say, hey, Palestinians are Semites. That will stop overnight.
It's like,
how ignorant are they to say such a thing?
You know, but that's it, because it's become a catchphrase, the term anti-Semitic. And I just hate it because it's against me, ignorant people. And it's like, you know, you people are just too stupid. You know, I don't suffer stupidity for very long. I can't. there's no excuse now for people to, you know, there's some people who are ignorant and proud of it, and it's like,
of
all the things in the world you could do and be proud of, you know, having your head stuck up your butt is not one of them, but, you know, who are we? But what else, but besides the retribution, the retaliation for the supposed,
they killed chickens in Gaza. They killed the chicken farm again near Khan Yunis. There's a huge chicken farm. They blew up all the chickens.
I guess they
don't want the Palestinians to have proper food. I mean, chicken is an important part of their diet. The chicken soup. And
it's nothing that we would be eating, but it is part of
you know?
Diet. I mean, and
poor
the
chickens.
Egg, everything.
People are dead in Gaza. Soon I will get the numbers. It's just someone who was shot the other day is dead now. So there, lots of young people are dying in Gaza in the West Bank. Kids have been shot. People have been woken up in the middle of the night in the West Bank by dogs biting them. They sent dogs into the... Yeah, I read that in... just before I called you, I was reading about it. And I know the Israeli army uses dogs to attack people, because when I was in the Israeli army 3 months, we had the dog base right outside my base, and they would always growl at me real mean through the fence. Mean dogs.
They taught them to be that way. I don't know how,
but my dogs would never act this way.
Well, that's because you're good to your dogs, but you train dogs by being mean to them.
Oh, my God, that's abusive, too.
Well, yeah.
That's how they train soldiers, by being mean to them, too.
Yeah, yeah. When part of that that breakdown, here we call it basic training, but it's probably the same around the world. You have them for 6-8 weeks or whatever, and you just, rant and rave and tell them they're scum of the earth and how low they are. You totally break them down. This is what mind control. This is the way you work with mind control. Then you start to build them up the way you want them to be. So then you get these... that are barely human in ways. So sure, they training the soldiers, training the dogs is all the same. I mean, as far as, for the outcome, you have to break them down.
They arrested Samira Lasawi.
Say that again, I'm sorry?
Remember Samira Lasawi, the hunger striker that almost died from hunger? He's arrested again. That made me so sad. I really like him. I was starting to, get to know him. Get to know him because I admired his strength to be on hunger strike so long, and now they took him again.
See, that's it. Somebody will get out somehow from their prisons, and then before you know it, they've grabbed him from some other... charge that, and well, they don't even charge them, because they don't have to. They can just grab them and take them away.
Yeah, that's the magic of administrative detention.
Isn't that horrid?
4 Palestinians murdered last night only. I think more than 4, but probably talking in the way. Oh, in Gaza City, I'm sure more will die of their wounds.
I don't know. What were they doing in Gaza anyway, besides blowing up chickens, idiots?
The death of a Palestinian girl at the age of 3 years old was killed in Gaza, June 25. Her family's wounded in the blast.
A baby. Yeah.
A total baby.
Yeah.
So war against babies. Half of Gaza are under 18.
But this is what the U.S. is doing in other countries. I mean,
they learn from each other.
Murder whoever's there. And so, so then the U.S. okays it for Israel, too, because they're up each other's butts. So you don't have to have a targeted person. Just go and kill, to be killing, to be experimenting with new methods, with new weapons. Give your army something to do. Go kill some innocent people.
What the Israeli right-wingers say?
What?
I was looking today at what they are saying. You should never be happy for Arabs, especially Muslims. They want to kill us all. We should never believe them. It doesn't matter if it's Hamas or Abu Mazen or Abu Pita. Just making fun of their name now, like it's a pita bread. I must say that. Shows lack of intelligence, what he's saying. Another thing they always like to say is that there's no one to talk to. They like to talk about killing,
Isn't that ridiculous?
A death sentence, like Eichmann, anyone who tries to hurt Israel, blah, 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 death sentence.
No.
Talking about a real fascist state.
No. Seriously. On the good side, well, I guess I wanted to wish a happy birthday to Guy Butavia.
Guy Butavia. How are you? How is he doing? Yeah. Let's see.
It is his birthday. So, God knows they don't like him.
I know all the Israeli activists are hysterical right now because the Palestinian friends are like our brothers and sisters by now, and we don't like to know that they are being hurt.
Well, right. I mean, they go and march in the West Bank with them all the time. I mean, they march together, and then when you find out that the Israeli army is doing these horrible things to your friends, and, you know, like, it's like people here in the United States, we you know, we make friends with other people in other countries, and then we find out that our government is going in and droning their relatives, if not them. It's such a horrible thing we're all facing right now.
I'm getting all kinds of reports from the West Bank.
What are they saying?
All bad, all saying there's sounds of explosions and dogs and hundreds of soldiers going into refugee camps, and it's very worrying.
Okay, because right now it's almost 8 o'clock here, which means, I think, aren't we 8 hours difference? I believe. If we are, that would put it almost 4
yeah.
in the there.
Yeah, it should be like early in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah, before the sun is up and all. I mean, this is, like, it's a favorite time to attack. Yeah. I mean, they attack any time of day, but it seems like there's more terror when you attack people in the middle of the night. So, of course, they will be doing that. But the explosions, what are these... like small missiles, or what are they doing?
I think they're blowing up doors to get in the houses. I've heard a testimony from Breaking the Silence of them breaking walls and doors to get in, and sometimes they break someone's hand, blow up someone's hand when they blow up the door, and they try to open the door at the same time. Very careless when it comes to Palestinian. Doesn't mean their life means nothing.
Okay, of course that would be because you're trying to hold the door or whatever, and they're so busy with their, what do you call it, C3, C4, C whatever, with their little bits of explosives. So of course hands are going to go, oh my God. That's, these things.
Beating up people in front of their children is so damaging to them and their kids. Everything about military occupation is worse than anyone's nightmare.
Yeah, and
my friend from Gaza says, it is time to sleep. Even there, and there are Israeli attacks, we are adjusted to live under such conditions. No more choices, so I could get some rest.
That's something nobody should ever become accustomed to. Never, ever. And yet, I mean, they have to because they have to sleep. And, you know, well, for years we've had our friends say that, I mean, they just hear those drones all the time. They study to that. They study by candlelight because their electricity's cut off every day. And so they just, it becomes a way of life. And these kids are being born into it. They've never known any other, which is so sad.
My friend who teaches English, I can talk to him. He's got really good English, and he's a great guy. And he says, as far as I know, they've been attacked every night since last time I spoke to you. Maybe one night it was just one explosion, but it's been every night as far as I see. The world, totally, the media, mainstream media is such a criminal, not to mention it.
Yeah, yeah. But we know who owns the media, and you know we know the we know what the owners of the media want to put out there. So we're not going to hear the truth. We just have to keep letting people know. There's just such a what you call such a dearth. Like there is no, I mean, there's we have to say on mainstream media there's going to be some kinds of truth get through once in a while, but not about these things we're talking about. And I don't know.
Oh, did I tell you I was talking to a mother of a conscientious objector? She told me her son is not allowed to talk to anyone in jail. And it breaks them. It breaks their spirit. Some of them actually go mad because apparently not talking to anyone for months is really hard on us humans. We're not meant to be that way.
No, but we're not meant to be locked up, and we're definitely not. I mean, well, we're social
locked up with no medical care if you're sick.
Right.
Isn't that a crime?
And being fed just looks like a kind of slop. And like you had said before, the the prison's dank and dark, and you know there's nothing. And then just to be in solitary confinement that whole time, that's. I mean, even if they didn't take him out and beat him, I mean, just the fact that you can't interact with another human.
Of course, Palestinian prisoners all get tortured, including the children. I was reading an Israeli psychiatrist talking about it. But the Israeli ones get tortured in the way that they're not allowed to talk. And he's only 18. His mother is so kind. We were chatting for a long time about everything. Real sweet family. There's a lot of people refusing to serve in IDF. They're treated terrible. In Israel, it's much hotter than in the States in the summer, and they have no air conditioning.
Yeah.
That's very cruel. I would just die from the heat.
They can't be healthy because we know that they're not getting good, nutritious meals. Okay, so, you know... Right, if you're really being fed good, if you're getting nutritional things that are good for you, you can withstand a lot, but when that isn't the case, it makes it even harder.
They were shooting straight at protesters this weekend in Abi Salah in Palestine. I shared it on the page, Daily Life in Palestine, 7 hours ago. It's pretty horrific. Many, many people are being taken to jail. It's terrible.
We keep saying, like, we don't understand how they can do it, but yes, we do, because it is a form of, I mean, it's brainwashing. This is what's happened. So this is the result of mind control.
Totally. Totally mind control.
And the thing is, it's going to have to change, and people are going to have to be the ones to change it. We just have to keep telling people what's going on. And get them just to be interested in, get them to see or feel what it would be like, what they think they would feel like if this were happening to them or to their children. You know, make see that we're all people. We're all the same. I mean, other people love their kids too and don't want them tortured. They don't want their homes broken into. They don't want to be strip searched in front of their kids and whatever.
Absolutely. I was talking to Israelis. They don't seem to know much about that.
No.
Some of them believe me and cry when I tell them.
Yeah.
They get very sad.
Yes. Yes. Because they're human. And
some are, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so it's... everybody hasn't lost their humanity, but they... You know, they have to start losing their belief in their government. And, you know, pretty much like we have, a lot of the people in the United States, a lot of the people around the world don't believe the lies their governments tell them anymore. And this is something the Israelis are going to have to face up to. Their government
sucks. I hope so.
You know, it's you can only defend it for so long And then when you keep having evidence thrown in your face, then, I speak from experience, because, I mean, I didn't want to believe that the U.S. government is as corrupt as it is. I didn't want to believe that for a long time, but I just couldn't deny it any longer. So I feel that it's that way with them. So they just have to be confronted all the time with the truth.
Today, no one sleeps in the Dahisha refugee camp, the city of Bethlehem, Palestine. More than 1,000 soldiers invaded the camp last night. 30 people have been arrested, 5 have been injured. Some have been shot, and 2 had been run over by military jeeps. That's a report from an Israeli girl who has friends in that camp. Tear gas bombs. I can see the flash of stun grenades 2 streets down and hear the noise of the sound of grenade and bullets in the distance. Later, family confirms that they are using live ammunition. The soldiers have also arrested another friend, taking him blindfolded and handcuffed. When the sound of the bullets disperses and fades away, we peek through the window, discover a troop of more than 40 soldiers moving silently in the darkness. That's such terror they have to live with.
I would think that there would just be heart attacks from, I mean, just straight up from fear. I just don't know how they go on and how they can still be so gracious.
And so strong.
Very strong.
It's amazing.
It's one of those things, you know, when you're really, really, really right, and you know you're right, you can't cave. But if somebody does, it's like, well, you know, you can't fault them either, because they've just run out of whatever, and people basically want to live, so sometimes they make compromises. And that's where you sometimes get traitors, or, you know, so-called traitors, because they make compromises because they want to live, they want their family to live.
All
of that.
So a woman in England was stabbed for wearing a hijab, killed.
Oh, see, the European countries...
That's anti-Semitism.
Fascists, they're getting more fascist, too.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Poverty does that to people, dumbs them down, I guess.
Yeah, it does seem to. It's you know, I mean, then you'll have your exceptions who get strong and on the right path from poverty, but so many people, like you say, it doesn't work that way.
So Israel is investing $17 million in immigration, probably more than that, and they're not telling us.
Oh, I would think more, yeah.
Because the people in the settlements don't pay any taxes and get their houses half price.
Right. Well, like you've said before, I mean, you could go and get a place for very low cost, much cheaper than you get it where you live now in Nashville.
I could.
You know.
If
I
was, that's true.
So, Sarit, once again, our time is at that point. Thank you so much, and hopefully next week, well, at least hopefully there's not going to be this false retaliation stuff still going on. We can only pray and cross our fingers. But,
yeah, I can tell IDF is dying to see a third intifada so they can shoot more live ammunition.
No, yeah. this is true. They're really, well, you know, they've got weapons that the U.S. helped buy. They've got to try them out. Isn't that sad?
That's how it works.
Yeah, that's the way it works. We'll see you next Wednesday, same time.
Great, great.
Thank you.
Talk to you next Wednesday.
Bye-bye. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening and welcome to UFO Paranormal and Mystical Insights. Hello, Steve.
Hi. Good evening, Ruthann. This is our new slot, I guess. It's a little bit later.
Right.
But somehow it's appropriate because it's darker, so we can make sightings.
There we go. Right. Yeah. And now that we've had summer solstice, the days are getting shorter already.
I know. Well, you can make, I'm sure the atmosphere where you live is a lot better than in New York City.
Yeah, we still have clean air, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all the light interference that makes observing the atmosphere very hard in New York.
Yeah, I know that. It's that way when I'm in Chicago. It's like, wow, it's beautiful. I love the city. But you can't really see that much.
Oh, I mean, if you go into a rural area, I'm amazed. I look at the sky, I think I'm at a planetarium.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago, we brought a friend from Chicago downstate, and we stopped out. It was the wintertime, and we stopped out in the area where, that there would be bean and corn growing the next summer. And she had never seen anything like that. Like you said, I mean, it was just like a planetarium. And it was so cold and everything, but, I mean, we were there for a long time because she was just, like, in awe looking at the stars.
Right.
Yeah, it's great.
So tonight we're going to discuss exopolitics, which is a field of learning that I first heard about, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Michael Sala is involved in it, and this is one area. Usually when I talk about different areas, I have something to go on, and this is one area in which anything I might say is pure speculation, and I don't know that anyone has any good information on this. I think Sala, I read some of his books, and he seems to have elaborate theories about, galactic federations and all kinds of stuff, which I don't really see any proof for, but, certainly from time to time people have speculated, but if there are UFOs and if there are advanced craft visiting us, and the evidence seems to be pretty conclusive at this point that they are, then you wonder what kind of civilizations they come from. And if you're wondering what kind of civilizations they come from, then you start thinking about the issues of, well, what kind of religions might they have, and how do they regulate their affairs? Do they have anything that resembles politics and so on and so forth. Do you know anything about this?
I really don't. I would suggest that people Google, or I don't use Google, but DuckDuck or whoever, Neil Gould. I have interviewed him before. He is from U.S. He lives in Hong Kong now, and he's part of an organization that is definitely an exopolitical organization. He has a lot to say, and a lot of it, like you say, is people are surmising a lot of things, but if we're going to believe that people have had contact, then we must believe other things that they say about these beings from other places. So, I mean, I have no problem seeing them as just other entities like we are, with the kinds of thoughts and social structures and things. I mean, not that their social structures might be as backward as ours, but they must have some, in some way, to have gotten as advanced as they are. And because they have to be advanced because they have come here. It's not that we have gone there. They have come here.
Right. Well, I've certainly read accounts of people, the Betty and Barney Hills story where they were taken aboard a craft in the early 60s.
Right, way back, yeah.
Yeah, and it was one of the earliest reported, and it actually is one of the most credible and has held up the best in terms of, but like a lot of the reports of people who have actually had direct encounters, they said nothing about anything about what we're discussing in terms of what type of politics or religion or so on. They were discussing their experiences with these entities, and the entities seemed most interested in, you know, the biological and psychological makeup of humans rather than anything else that they could relate. So I have not, heard any accounts. I mean, there are various theories. One theory is that to be technologically very developed, it would probably require the cooperation of an entire planet to pool resources or so on. Again, pure speculation, but, it would require something more like a planetary society than what we have, in which we're broken up into different countries. And the countries, you know, all have their own, you know, priorities and so on and so forth. Well, something like the International Space Station, which, where there's astronauts for several countries. That's the kind of idea. You couldn't see it being the effort of one particular subdivision, but maybe it could be. I don't know. You know? It depends on your theories.
I want to ask you, you mentioned Michael Sala, I believe?
Yeah.
Right? Okay, I'm just looking at Neil Gould is the director of the Exopolitics Institute, founded by Dr. Michael Sala.
Right. So we're talking about the same people.
The same people. You know? And I just want to say, I made a mistake. Neil is not from the U.S. He is from South Africa originally, but living in Hong Kong now. Yes.
Oh. Well, I mean, I read some of his stuff, and it didn't make much of an impact on me, apparently, because, I used to get emails from that institute, and they give courses like interplanetary diplomacy, and I mean, I've never looked at it in detail, but I don't know where they're getting their information. I mean, maybe you do. You know,
I don't remember a lot about the interview. They're getting their information just like Neil himself had experiences, and a lot of people. I mean, they're getting their information from contactees, of course.
What are these people saying?
Well, everybody has something different. I think on one of our shows, I had mentioned how. One woman who was, exposed to them, was a very religious, as in Christian, woman here on this planet.
Right.
And she was scared, and she communicated to them, because a lot of this is just telepathic. And she was saying, well, what about God? And the answer was, well, he's the same, like God, he's the same to us as to you. And she felt very comforted and reassured by that. So there's been, all contactees are not just terrified and their mind blanked out from their experience. I mean, you know, some are, and then some over years, they start to remember things, or there's a trigger, and they start remembering.
Well, I mean, so do you remember what she said about it?
That was what she said.
That was what she said. Nothing about the politics, but strictly about the religion.
No, that was about religion. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, the Vatican, one of the Vatican theologians was interviewed. I forget his name right now. And, you know, they believe that these entities have visited us, and they seem to have no problem with the idea that, you know, the supreme higher power or spiritual powers or God or whatever you want to call the guiding intelligences in the universe are... they have no problem in accepting the idea that creation encompasses more than just the Earth.
More than this tiny little planet, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's like anybody who being reasonable would have to, in my opinion, would have to admit that. And that's
right.
Not to, you know, it's not to put down these dogmatic, small-minded religions, but... How can you think that such a tiny planet as Earth in all the multiverses would, that there would only be one supreme being that cares only for this tiny little planet? That makes no sense.
No, well, I mean, it's kind of analogous to when, you know, people believe that the Earth was the center of the, that the sun revolved around the Earth. And, you know, the Ptolemaic theory, and then, you know, when I think it was either Kepler or Galileo, you know, showed, no, it's actually the other way around, that we are actually circling the moon, rather the sun, because, you know, from observations on Earth, just primitive observations, you know, the sun seems to be revolving around us. I mean, it comes up, it goes down, and, you know.
Right.
So it's the same thing with this. I mean, to think that, you know, this speck of dust floating on an ocean of cosmic energy is, you know, the only life, intelligent life in the universe is mathematically, even mathematically, it's been shown to be very, very improbable that that would be the case. I mean, there's some sort of thing called the Drake formula or the Drake equation in which in our own galaxy alone, I think it was estimated that there would be maybe 40,000 advanced civilizations, not including the other life, which perhaps is not as advanced or, you know, is not, you know, different types of life that, you know, maybe based on a different biochemistry and so on and so on. So, you know, now, whenever you have, you know, that type of intelligence, you're going to have societies and, you know, then there's various speculation and... I always go back to that movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, in which some extraterrestrial civilization, I'm talking about it came from a short story, actually, but I'm talking about the one that was made in the early 50s, not the remake, which wasn't bad, but wasn't, in my opinion, as good. Mm-hmm. And he was sent down here because after the creation of nuclear weapons, you know, the Earth societies were becoming a danger, a possible danger to other living societies in space. And he came down and, you know, he was trying to explain to the leaders here that the civilization he came from developed a way to abolish war. And, of course, it was very hard for him to get his message through, but finally he told the gathering of scientists before he left, because he couldn't get the politicians to listen to him. They wouldn't meet with each other, or it was too difficult, or they kept trying to capture him and all kinds of crazy things. The military wanted him. So finally he said, you know, we created massive robots that patrol the galaxies in spacecraft, and they are programmed to monitor all of the living civilizations that we know about. And at any sign of war or aggression or killing that goes on, they're like, you know, they just can either obliterate that civilization or obliterate what's going on. And because of that, nobody dares start a war. And they have been programmed in such a way that they could not be deprogrammed. So once they created them, they couldn't stop them. In other words, there was no known way of short-circuiting them. And he said, thus, you know, we live in peace. So I'm telling you that, you know, you better find a way of stopping, your conflicts. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's interesting. That's kind of like saying that, there must be some external force, kind of like an interplanetary police force, in effect.
Ah.
To stop people from killing each other in wars and to stop wars. And the only way to stop wars, you couldn't reason with people, so the only way to do it was have a superior force and say if you start a war, those people who are engaged in war, those countries or whatever, will just be obliterated.
Well, that was one of the theories I read about, and I mentioned this before too, that the, I had wondered why we just quit all the moon experimentations and sending people to the moon kind of thing. And one of the theories was that, you know, of course, that governments on this planet have been contacted and that there was just a, quarantine pretty much put on Earth until they didn't want the warlike Earthlings messing up space. And it was pretty much, you know, until you can get it together, we don't want you coming around. So,
well, I mean, it's along the same
theory.
Lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I think that, you know, when you read about different things that the astronauts have seen, that they've seen things that were not of the Earth, and that this
right.
could be like, you know, patrols, whatever. It can be just, you know, other beings wanting to know what's going on here. But it can be those who are trying to just make sure that we don't get in certain areas and mess things up any more than we, you know, have already, and like we do here on this planet. So that would make sense with what you're saying, that coming from other planets or galaxies where it would be the whole planet working together or several planets working together.
Right. Right.
And this very small planet Earth that we know can't even get countries to work together unless they're causing war on other countries, basically. So we do have quite a ways to go.
Well, I mean, in effect, really, there's almost been a regression on Earth. Because
yes.
Why say regression? Maybe the whole Enlightenment theory that history provides some kind of historical progress is actually wrong. But if you accept that theory that there is historical progress, I mean progress in the human consciousness and human development, I don't mean progress in technology.
No.
I mean the resort to force now is as bad, if not worse, than any time in human history as a first resort, since World War II. When the United Nations was created, it was created primarily to prevent wars. And now it seems to sanction wars.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is a total and complete reversal of what it was actually created to do. And without an international peacekeeping force that has the ability and the power to do that, you know, it seems to me there's more conflict now than at any time since World War II, so I don't think we're, you know, if you believe in historical progress, we seem to have regressed. We're in worse shape. We're in the worst shape that we've been on Earth in terms of war since probably just before World War One broke out.
Well, I know in our right, at least within our lifetimes, for sure.
Yeah, and within our lifetimes, of course, we didn't see that, but we're the post World War II generation in which. We grew up with the specter of nuclear war with the Soviet Union, you know, but early on after the war, before the Cold War really set in, you know, there was hope that the United Nations would be more effective at preventing conflict than the League of Nations. Right. And in the very early days, a hope that proved to be utopian, but FDR and his advisors and the other people there, the victorious, so-called victorious countries like the Soviet Union, the U.S., England, and all those that are now permanent members of the Security Council, you know, in the very early days, this was the main reason behind it, and you know, it seems that an intellectual understanding that this is necessary has not been enough to get over the emotional, to advance people's spiritual development or emotional development enough to stop these things from occurring. And, you know, now the UN has done a lot of good things. I mean, it has prevented, I think particularly, you know, with the Cuban Missile Crisis and so on, which was the closest we came to nuclear war, I think, you know, it played an important role in that and so on. So it hasn't been a complete failure, but I wonder what FDR would really think about it, you know, about the some of the things that have been sanctioned by the UN. I don't think he would be very happy about it. And, you know, I think about this. I think about a lecture I once heard from a guy who was a young lawyer at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal. And he had been in Germany. He was still alive. I think he may still be alive. He's quite elderly, but, you know, he's still speaking, made his life's work trying to prevent these war crimes from ever happening again. And I can imagine the way he feels in the past, what's happened in the past decades. You know, and he spent his whole life going around, you know, lecturing about the necessity for international law and, you know, that would be effective to stop this kind of thing from occurring and so on and so forth. So, but to get back to the original point, it was interesting in that movie that the emissary from this other star system asked to speak to all the leaders of the Earth. And even back then, I think it was 1951 the movie was made, the character that was supposedly representing the U.S. president said, you know, be too difficult, that the leaders wouldn't agree and some of them wouldn't sit down at the same table with each other, and, you know. So, you know, that's one idea that, you know, and of course, there's two major camps on all this. There's the camp that says that there's hostile UFOs. So then we're in a, like, warlike situation.
Right.
So if the UFOs are hostile, obviously they're not interested in peacekeeping. And then you have the other theory that they're not all hostile, that there's some that would be friendly and could be friendly, but maybe avoiding more direct contact because of the primitive and dangerous conditions here.
Right. I mean,
I mean, if you think about it, and you know, if you came from a civilization that was much more advanced and had gotten over the phase of possible self-annihilation and had dealt with some of these problems, and they would have had to do that to get as far as to create interstellar travel, which is something that would take quite a long time to perfect. I mean, you're going to survive and actually explore all of these things. I mean, they have to have some way of containing conflicts within their own society. Otherwise, they would be bogged down where they were. And, there's also a theory that they don't make more direct contacts, and they haven't been, except for these isolated instances, for sure they've been seen around military installations and so on, but why there hasn't been more of an attempt to make open contact and have, open communication. And, of course, some people say they have attempted, and the authorities of the military have suppressed all of that and are in secret contact with some of these civilizations. That's another theory that, has been brought out. And,
which makes a lot of sense, since they try to keep so much from us and lie to us. I mean, that would make sense, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it was really treated, coming out of World War II, it was treated as a national security issue. And they didn't want it to get out into the public, they wanted to keep it a secret, perhaps get the technology, more advanced technology from these entities, or for other reasons. They didn't want to panic people and various other reasons, but I think that, probably all of the above is true. I mean, probably we've had both friendly and unfriendly encounters, because certainly the Wilhelm Reich, for one, who was in his later years started to get involved in the observation of UFOs. He had seen some up in Rangeley, Maine, which is, at that time and even today, is still a pretty pristine region where you can look up into the sky and, on clear nights, this tremendous visibility. He made observations there. And in Arizona, by the time he got to Arizona, he felt that these particular spacecraft were emitting some kind of substance to create deserts, that they came from a desert-like planet, and that they were trying to make, an attempt. They were attracted to desert-like areas here, and he felt that they weren't friendly. He felt that their intentions were to colonize the Earth, in effect.
Well, the Earth was, depending on how you think we came to be here, we were a colony. We were colonized way, 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 way back. So the idea that somebody might want to do that now is not that outrageous.
Well, true. I mean, the theory that life came here from outside of the Earth, I mean, this theory that's been around for a long, long time, of course, it's a theory that Well, I mean, if you think of religions, religions actually recognize that theory. Scientists don't, but there are some religions recognize that some higher intelligence created us. And if some higher intelligence created us, that's an extraterrestrial intelligence. You know, whether they seeded the Earth or whatever they did to bring it here. And, of course, the scientists feel that there was a process of natural evolution, which there was no outside intelligent force involved in.
Right. You
know? So, in effect, really, I think the religions, some of them, I think perhaps all of them, but not all of them, but a good majority of what we would consider the more organized and older major religions, you know, feel that way. Of course, that there's this dispute between creationism and the theory of evolution, which, you know, science says it's not a theory. Science says this is a fact. And evolution is the theory to explain the fact of how species have evolved, you know, through natural selection and other things. And, you know, the creationists, however far back you want to go, you know, believe otherwise, you know.
I just want to interject that there was something recently, I saw that the UK now, is they just passed something as far as education where they can no longer teach anything really about creationism as like some, you know, teach it as a viable theory or something, but they can't do that anymore, as opposed to the U.S. where so many schools are trying to block anything to do with evolution again.
Well, that's why I think it's kind of a regression. It's actually educational malpractice, because you want your students, you know, who want to go to college, and even those who don't, you want them to have accurate information.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, the evolution should be taught, period. Now, something like the idea of creationism versus evolution, to me that could also be taught, but not in a religious context, more philosophically, maybe in a philosophy course or something like that, you know, as, you know, the intelligent design, and, you know, there's various arguments for the existence of God and all this kind of thing that, you know, could be explored, but not as a competing scientific theory. Because it doesn't fit scientifically, you know, at all, in any recognized way. And the other thing that, you know, perhaps we were, you know, brought here or designed, you know, by alien intelligences or entities, that also has some problems, because that goes against the theory of evolution. As far as the theory of evolution is concerned, our ancestors, in prehistoric times, going way back, I don't know how far back, I don't know, 100,000 years or 500,000 years or whatever it was, you know, were small mammals that lived in trees. They were our ancestors. And, you know, through the process of evolution, you know, the Homo sapiens and also the Neanderthals developed. And, you know, that because of our intelligence, we were able to survive, and the Neanderthals died out for one reason or another. Maybe they didn't have the intellectual capacity to cope with the various problems that were around, or, you know, I don't know. So if you say that we were brought here in some form by alien entities, that's a counter-evolutionary theory.
But see, I don't know why we can't have all. Why does it have to be either or?
Well,
why couldn't we have come from different sources and then, you know, somebody from here and someone from there got together, and down through the ages, we came up with what we have now. I just don't understand why it has to be either or.
Well, where it contradicts, you do have to make a choice. In other words, if alien entities had a role in bringing us here, then Darwin is wrong. So you can't both have Darwin and the theory of an alien intervention.
Because there's
only one possibility, and that possibility is that, you know, the most primitive form of life was seeded from outer space. In other words, in the seas, the one-celled entities or organisms or whatever that were precursors to all life, you know, that would be consistent. In other words, it didn't generate spontaneously by itself on Earth, but there was an alien intelligence that sort of seeded the Earth with these very primitive forms of life, which then evolved. So you couldn't say that humans as a race were brought here in a developed state. If you do, then you have to reject Darwin, because according to Darwinian theory, that what happened is, you know, life started in the waters and the oceans, and, you know, when the conditions were right, you know, it developed, and then, you know, primitive cellular organisms developed, and then, you know, there was an evolution to more and more sophisticated conglomerations of cells, and then, you know, eventually, it came out of the sea, and you had living creatures on the earth, and so on and so forth. But I mean, those, and I know there are a couple of them around who say that, you know, human beings were brought to Earth and deposited in the Middle East or something, you know, that you can't, if you go with that, then you have to reject Darwin.
See, I don't think so, but that's a whole other talk.
But yeah, I mean, unless you want to say that everything else evolved and human beings are completely unique, which really brings us back to it's a form of creationism. You know what I'm saying? But that's another discussion. But at any rate, you know, getting back to the main point, I haven't seen anything that's any real good information about how extraterrestrial societies may be constructed other than speculation, you know. I mean, I don't know what Michael Saylor and all those people, I do know one thing, that when I was reading one of his books, it seemed to me that he was just stating things as facts without providing evidence.
Ah.
And, you know, that's not acceptable, you know, it's not part of the basic rules of learning and a verification of reality that you just can make, except if you're a politician. You can just make statements and not prove it. Well, politicians do that all the time. They make all kinds of claims without any evidence. And, you know, now, I don't know where he gets his information. Maybe he does have some evidence, but I stopped reading the book I was reading because it seems to me he was just saying these things, you know, and I couldn't see the support for them. And you really can't just rely on information that people say they've had contacts with these entities and told them these things. You have to have some more evidence of that, you know, because people can fantasize or, you know, I mean, now it might be quite, you know, that I believe there have been encounters. I believe we, you know, that there are other civilizations. But you need, to my way of thinking, when you're starting to talk, get down to that amount of detail, you got to provide some credible evidence, you know?
Yeah, and what you're I think though from what I've seen with like the website, there's a lot of and this is exopolitics.com, everyone.
Right.
If you type that in, it will go to exopoliticshongkong.com.
Right.
But from what I've seen, the word politics, I wouldn't know what they could use other than it actually, but it doesn't, I don't get from them or from talking to Neil, I don't get that we're talking politics, like we think politics here, but the politics of meeting and working with others is what it's involved in, as far as I can tell.
Oh, in other words, in preparation.
And so it's So they have a lot of things with people who have been contactees, and that kind of thing. So you know a lot
well,
of.
Well, I mean, I could see studying, and perhaps the UN I think has done some preliminary work on this, studying various ways that contact would be handled from a political standpoint. In case it happens, not that it has already happened. That's different, you know. And yes, now that you're refreshing my recollection, I think some of what I read had to do with that. But I got the impression that he was treating this as something which is an established reality.
Okay, I just get a lot from the contacts that have been made. So not necessarily talking about politics like we think about politics in this country, but, you know, people's impressions as far as what the, I don't like that word alien, but anyway, what the non-earthly beings, what they may be wanting, what they're here for. And there again, like you said earlier, a lot of people have different, and I don't know if this would hold because I'm sure that there's some of these entities that aren't all that friendly, but I know here, just in the human world, that a lot of people put out certain energies, and that's what they attract. And
right.
So if you're putting out a lot of fear and things like that,
yes.
You're going to attract other humans who will feed on that, and you may encounter violence and things. If you're putting out a lot of love and confidence and isn't it a great world kind of energy, you're going to attract a lot of people who have that same vibration. So, you know, I think that a lot of these people who are so fear-bound are definitely going to attract, just like, you know, we've talked before about different spirits that you might have, whether you want to call them angels, guides, whatever. And some people seem, you know, to think that they're also terrible because they're putting out so much fear. And, like, that's never been my perception because I don't think like that. So I've never run into that kind of spirit. So I shouldn't say ever, but, you know, very, very rarely. So I think that that might be a lot of this also projection, you know, or our own vibrations. They're going to attract.
Well, that's true, too, I mean, so I read something from written by a modern day Kabbalist.
What
who
is
was
that?
It's a form of Jewish mysticism.
Right.
And this rabbi, very orthodox rabbi, wrote a pamphlet on UFOs, and you know he says that you know. There are extraterrestrial intelligences, you know, since going back since, you know, biblical times. But, you know, he puts it in the context of demons and angels and so on and so forth. And, you know, he puts it in that kind of a theological framework. But it is true that there's a lot of, you know, if people are very fearful, you know, and, you know, they're thinking that these things are demons and so on and so forth. That's, that's another problem there, you know.
Oh.
And then you get into fantasy things there, you know. It's the line between reality and fantasy becomes blurred. And,
yeah.
That's a big danger. And that that reality, you know, among some people, not all, has enabled the debunkers to say, you know, all of this is, you know, this is all fantasy or the product
right.
of people
overactive
who are
imagination.
Yeah, or I've heard, you know, people who may be like schizophrenic or schizotypal, people who hear voices and, you know, things of that nature, who, you know, that these are unreal experiences. You know, it's and that, of course, has been used to discredit the whole field. Not as success. I mean, after time and serious people began looking at all of this, it has faded pretty much. You know,
yeah.
And
well,
just like any, you know. Just like anything else, you have your legitimate serious people who have some serious evidence and some, reasonable arguments about it or reasonable forms of coming to conclusions. And then you have other people who are, you know, spaced out, you know.
But it's just like you said, didn't you say? We use maybe 6%, or we're aware of 6% of whatever.
Yeah.
So,
right.
You know, these people who are hearing voices, like, who am I to say they're not? There's a lot going on. Our minds are wonderful things, and thank goodness we're not all the same. We aren't all hearing the same voices.
Well, that's true. And
who's to say that they aren't onto something?
Well, this is a case where I think that some who do are, you know, in the category of what I would call a paranoid schizophrenic
yes.
or whatever.
Yes.
But some are not. You know, some
yeah.
are people who are actually getting communications, you know.
Yes.
And you have to separate the two. That, you know, there's an old story that sometimes there's a thin line between, you know, genius and madness, or
yes.
a thin line between sensitivity and intelligence and oversensitivity, I'll put it that way. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And, so, I mean, both things, are true. You do have people who are, you know, I mean, for instance, many, many years ago, there was a guy who made a big splash and published several books. In fact, I have one of his books published in the 50s, a very old volume. I have it somewhere, stored somewhere. George Adamski, I think his name was. Anyone who's familiar with the history of UFOs and so on would know the name, you know. He claimed he was taking he created a little kind of observatory facility for himself way out west someplace, and he claimed that he was picked up by a spaceship, you know, with humanoid occupants, and they took him to Venus. Well, we know that no human life could exist on Venus. I mean, no life such as anything resembling us. Maybe there's some kind of other primitive life form someplace there that can thrive in that environment. But
or
and
unless
he was
there
saying,
was some kind of what about if there was some kind of a colony set up, some kind of a that biodome kind of thing, you know, that somebody else had set up on Venus. Is that a possibility? He could have been taken there.
I think it's highly unlikely. I think it's an extremely inhospitable area.
Okay.
I mean, anything is possible if there's an advanced civilization. I mean, you know,
right.
anything is possible. But, you know, it's like Occam's razor. The law of Occam's razor is that, you know, the more variables you have to bring into trying to explain something, the less likely it is, because, you know, each variable has its own, you know, level of probability.
Right.
You know, so usually the simplest, most straightforward, and most logical
is the way
is explanation is usually closest to the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, I mean, you could rationalize away or try to find some way out of any of this stuff. But, you know, because we're dealing with so many unknown factors. But, you know, in that case, you know, I think, you know, there's still people who believe what he said. You know, I mean, he doesn't have any... I don't think he has a lot of current-day followers.
Okay.
I think there's still a few people around who espouse his philosophy. And he became very well known. I think he had an audience with the Pope at one time.
Let me ask you, do you think that the Pope, you know, because every few years was a different Pope, but do you think that the Pope about some things is as ignorant as, say, the President of the United States, because he doesn't know about everything? Or do you think that they actually tell the Pope, do you think he's more on top of things?
I think the spiritual people in general are more attuned to the whole phenomena of extraterrestrial visitation, entities from intelligent entities and spiritual presences from outside the earth. I think that that they're much more attuned to it than the materialist scientists are.
Yes.
Because the materialist scientists are too bogged down in this mechanical materialism, you know, of, you know, what kind of engine might it possibly have, and, if you can't kick the tires, does it exist? You know, but when you're dealing with higher dimensional intelligences, you know, these concepts just, they don't fit. And finally, I mean, in quantum physics and in cutting-edge physics, the physicists are the only scientists that I really know of, and they're actually in a natural science who have broken into phenomena that they cannot explain by the materialist Newtonian laws, and you know, out of the quantum physics and other and cosmology, black holes and other things, they have started to get into the realm that would be considered metaphysics. You know, there's a certain point to which the boundary dissolves.
Exactly.
But,
when you get to a certain yeah.
But, it's not necessarily the case that spirituality and science are opposed, because I think if there is any real future in human knowledge, those two fields are going to merge.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in human evolution, like you had that Jesuit philosopher and scientist, Teilhard de Chardin, who... he wrote various books about the knitting together of human intelligence and the psychic energies that were embodied in human beings, and that, you know, the possible future evolution of humanity and so on and so forth. And he called it Christogenesis. He said we're in the era of no genesis, in which, you know, there's like an interlacing intellectual contact throughout the world, and that the next stage would be something beyond, a dimension beyond that.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, these days, when the work first came out, he was prohibited from publishing all of this because the religious authorities felt in the church that there was some form of Gnosticism or, you know, because he was actually saying evolution is actually a way that this psychic energy was developing. It had reached its highest point in human beings, which both Alfred Adler and Wilhelm Reich, I think, would agree with that. And but the church refused to allow his stuff to be published if he wanted to remain within the order. In other words, if he wanted to remain a Jesuit priest and, you know, considered to be in good standing, he couldn't get that approval. You know, there's some kind of approval you need as a Catholic priest. There's some sort of approval you need for certain theological works and so on and so forth.
Right.
But his work was eventually posthumously published, you know, by the secular people, you know, by regular publishers, and, you know, he had followers. Now, for some reason, in recent years, I think his work has been, you know, some scientists have found fault with certain things, but, you know, he was moving in that direction, which I really think is the future of knowledge, because the most advanced thinkers that I have studied, almost all of them are actually on the cusp, the edge, like Wilhelm Reich or Teilhard de Chardin and other people, or these physicists. They're actually on the first, they've made the first step or two into this realm, you know. So I think actually that's really, if humanity survives, that's really the direction of where human knowledge will go, ultimately.
Yeah.
But, you know, the question of whether humanity will survive is more and more open to doubt, given the destructive forces that are loose on the earth and given the destructive technology that exists. I'm not really so sure that, you know, will, but in any case, I don't want to be too pessimistic, but the basic point is that there isn't a necessary conflict between religion and science, or I would make it more universal and say science is spirituality, however it's embodied, whether in organized or unorganized religion, because or just in existentially, because you know, this to me, this these two things are consistent if you pursue the right line of research and investigation. You know, they're compatible rather than antithetical, because the original battle going back into the Middle Ages is that the religious, organized religion, they wanted to suppress science. And then eventually it got to be peaceful coexistence, because science said, well, you know, we can't prove the claims that these religions are making, therefore we're science, they're religion, and, you know, it's two completely different things, and we're in, you know, there's no point of contact. But then as time went on, more and more, there was more and more avenues of contact were initiated, including, like, we have a Vatican observatory now. We have, you know, that the church is involved in and keeps up with the latest in scientific breakthroughs.
Oh, and major telescopes and things. I mean, the church is, yeah, it's not nearly as backward as, I should say the Catholic Church isn't nearly as backward as of these right-wing fanatical churches in this country. But you know what, Steve, once again, it's that time.
Well, it was enjoyable, you know, once we got into it. This is a topic that wasn't that easy to get into, because it's really a topic that is all over the place. And in this one area, these, you know, it's very, very speculative. But,
good.
You know,
so thank you, my friend.
That was enjoyable. Thank you very much, my friend.
Yeah, see you next Wednesday.
Next week. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.